is not like TV, only better.
It's only fair to pay for quality first-run movies.
What, that's it? That's your movie?
Well, I said that I had an idea for a movie.
Good afternoon, good evening, and good night. You are listening to Screen Watching. My name is Dan Barrett, and I'm joined by a man who has love in his heart, and he wants the world to know it. It's Simon Foster.
Oh, I have love in my heart. I am absolutely full of it. Hello, Dan Barrett. Hello, all the screen watchers out there. We have a huge show this week. We're going to celebrate Valentine's Day by posing that question, can or even should celebrity couples work together? We talk the big Chinese New Year movies. Happy New Year to all our Chinese listeners. Analyze the really good reason to watch the Super Bowl, the fresh movie trailers, plus some reviews of a new Mads Mikkelsen film. Plus a review of the new Mads Mikkelsen film and the new adventures of Clarice Starling. Everything you'll get to choose from in the next week of screen watching. It was exhausting putting this running sheet together, wasn't it?
Look, I had a massive nap straight afterwards and I feel better for it.
All right, let's kick off. What are we doing first?
Okay, Simon, let's take a look at the Super Bowl. And before we do, you said earlier we've got a whole bunch of movies coming up. I would arguably say the biggest trailer from the whole set was actually a streaming TV series. It's Marvel's Falcon and the Winter Soldier.
Who would like to start? Mr. Barnes, why does Sam aggravate you?
15 seconds to drop! So what's our plan? Hey.
Great.
Okay, so Simon, we had a couple of massive titles coming through. As I said, we've got the Falcon and Winter Soldier, which is the next big Marvel series that kicks off next month. So straight after WandaVision, I think there's like a week downtime and then we go straight into the next big one. Because this is the thing with Marvel, it's now dominating in a way that Marvel films kind of dominated the theaters for the couple of months where their 2 to 3 releases each year, you know, really own the box office for about 6 weeks there. And a lot of the cultural conversation around it, we're now getting that with TV. So for the months leading right up to June, you've got nothing but Marvel product, which is really going to be owning that pop culture zeitgeist. Where you've got WandaVision at the beginning, which, like you've said, the last few weeks, like conversations really ramping up there. Falcon and Winter Soldier's going to hit. And I think that's going to do a similar job of really driving a lot of conversation. But then that leads as well into, we've got supposedly Black Widow coming out. We've got the Loki TV show. And there's something else which dropped out of my mind as well. There's a fair bit of content taking us right into mid-June, if not into early July.
There really is. Does this indicate that, or what should I say, was the Winter Soldier TV series, TV concept, was that ever going to be a big screen movie? Was that pushed to Disney as a Disney Plus as a series, and sort of put the marquee on a big screen film?
No, so this is exactly it. So they are looking really at bringing big screen experiences to the TV. So Falcon and the Winter Soldier was never going to be a movie, really. It's because you try selling that as a movie and you might do okay, but it's not quite as marquee as some of the other hero titles you can put in there. And I think it's a bit of a hard ask saying, here's sort of two sub-Captain America characters who've now got their own movie, as opposed to, hey, here's Captain Marvel or some sort of other bigger title. But these two are perfect to lead a TV show. And going by the trailer for this, it kind of feels like Bad Boys, the TV show, but with tights.
Yeah, and I think you're absolutely right.
Yeah, and look, I was kind of down for that. And what I thought was cool about this for the Super Bowl is that this is kind of like a perfect Super Bowl kind of a trailer. So think about some of the other trailers they played. Like Fast and the Furious 9 was in there. There was Greenland, which is like the big action. What's his name?
Gerard Butler.
You've got Nobody, which is another sort of action sort of thriller film. You've got Coming to America, which is a fairly, you know, broad title. People know what that is.
Say that these are also going to, a lot of these titles are going to your streaming services. Coming to America too is headed for your home viewing platforms.
Well, this is the thing. So I was just going to say, so I got Rare and the Last Dragon and then Old, which is like the new M. Night Shyamalan film. But of all of those films, I think only 3 of them are actually playing in the theater. So Greenland is going straight to, at least in Australia, we're getting it on Amazon. I think that's a global
already
thing.
Happened. Yeah, it's already there.
It's already there. Oh gosh, what am I doing? I'm wasting my life. I should be watching the latest Gerard Butler film. Have you seen it?
I have seen it, yeah. It's pretty good. I really like it sort of drills down on the smaller family drama elements. And yeah, there's some big sort of meteor hitting the earth action scenes, but it's a bit of a surprise. I found it quite a moving film, and I've never said that about a Gerard Butler movie, but it's a quality bit of sort of Hollywood movie making.
Yeah, cool. Well, I'm pretty keen to check that out because it's a good looking film from what I've seen of it. Raya and the Last Dragon is going to go direct to Disney Plus. I think they call it Disney Plus Premium. So that's one of these films where you have to pay like $30 on top of your standard subscription.
Like they did with Mulan, yeah, earlier in the
exactly.
year.
You've got Coming to America, which is also going to Amazon. But then going to theaters, you've got this film Nobody, which is a thriller starring...
Bob Odenkirk.
Yeah. So Odenkirk starring in this, and like it looks like a really sort of tight, like interesting thriller. Fast and the Furious 9, everyone knows what's going on there. And
then holdover from last year, yeah, that was due out last year, but has been bumped to, so that we'll see how if that franchise still has staying power.
Yeah, and you got Falcon and Winter Soldier, which I saw that and it seemed like a perfect Super Bowl trailer because it's like a big, stupid action-adventure show. So I'm pretty keen to see what that looks like on the screen. Because the challenge for Marvel with that one is that you've got WandaVision, which very much plays into very traditional TV storytelling tropes and structures. So we haven't actually really seen Marvel go out there full bore with just an action-adventure show. Like, if you watch an action film on TV or video or DVD or however you're watching it, it never really quite has the same sort of razzle-dazzle as when you see it in the cinema. Like, it's
that's
not
exactly
as heart-pounding.
Right. You need that big screen experience. I absolutely agree.
Yeah, and these Marvel films are very much about the event. And I'll be honest, I find a lot of the Marvel stuff exciting in the cinema, and I find it a bit of a chore to watch at home. And so it's going to be really interesting to see how they go with this as a serialized action-adventure show.
Yeah, should work as well. Now, are we going to go head-to-head on the worth or not worth of M. Night Shyamalan? His new film, Old, the trailer premiered during the Super Bowl, as we mentioned. I'm keen. I'm a Shyamalan Ding Dong fan. I am very excited about this new one, which looks very creepy, very scary. You, not so much.
Look, I mean, casual racism aside, I quite like the Shyamalan as well. Here's the thing. I saw the ad for Old and I'm like, perfect. I'm absolutely down for that. But I'll say, I think he's got a 50-50 strike rate. Some of my favorite films are his. And yeah, also some of the worst experience I've ever had trying to sit through a movie also come from the mind of M. Night.
We might have to take this to the Facebook page, get people talking about it. But I think he's only really made one bad film, the one with Mark Wahlberg about the killer trees. What was that called?
That was called The Happening. And I actually ranked that as my favorite of all his films. Look, it's not a good movie, but it's a great beer movie.
You had me at it's not a good movie. But I was a fan of The Village. I thought it was a terrific film. I'm a huge fan of Signs. I think that's arguably his best film. I'll even go to bat for Lady in the Water, which I thought was a really interesting idea. A little flawed, but had some good stuff in there. And even his recent stuff, Glass and Split and those sort of movies. So, oh, and The Visit. I loved The Visit, which was his sort of take on the found footage type thing. So, yes, I'm a fan, and I think Old should be a pretty terrific movie-going experience. A lot of stuff to see during the Super Bowl halftime and ad break. So, well covered, Dan.
Yeah. The thing that I thought was maybe missing from the Super Bowl this year was the thing that Netflix did once, and I know I expect it every year, but it's not going to happen again, which was maybe one of the best marketing moves I've ever seen, like, really in the history of anything. They had an ad a couple of years ago during the Super Bowl for a new film that they just bought from, I think Universal had it, The Cloverfield Paradox, which was the third film in the Cloverfield series. And they just said, hey, look, here's a trailer. Also, if you want to see the movie, it's going to be on straight after the Super Bowl. They hadn't announced that they even had the film. There were rumors they had it, but it hadn't been officially announced. And they said, not only do we have it, but you can watch it right now. And to me, that is a brilliant move, because the thing with the Super Bowl is that they structure it so that whatever network has it, this year it was CBS. What they'll do is straight after the game, they'll have their post-game wrap-up, and then they'll go to some sort of show that the network wants to launch and create like a fair bit of buzz around that show. It usually brings in huge ratings for that, and very rarely does it translate to success for that show going forward. This year they tried it with The Equalizer, being the new series based on the TV show, and there was the Denzel Washington films. This has Queen Latifah in it. And from what I understand about it, it's a pretty middling sort of CBS procedural series. Huge ratings for that. You know, not so much probably when it actually launches throughout the week. But if you're Netflix and you've got some counter-programming to watching The Equalizer, I know I'd totally watch whatever the big Netflix film is of the moment rather than sitting through The Equalizer.
I think there was some clever programming on the part of Netflix when they did that for the Cloverfield Paradox, because there was a lot of internet buzz about it. No one had seen the film. When everyone saw the film, they realized how awful it was.
Oh, it was
so
dire.
What they were able to do was to get it out there, sell all sizzle and no steak, and it worked for a few days. People tuned in and watched it. So you're right. I think it is a missed opportunity for some of the streaming platforms to piggyback the big game into their big movie.
Yeah, and just as we wrap up, just a bit of trivia. The Falcon and Winter Soldier trailer, in the couple of days following it, so the 24 hours following it really, it's actually become the most watched streaming series trailer that we've seen to date. So 125 million people watched it. That broke the viewing record for last year's Black Widow spot, which had 119 million people checking it out. And also, WandaVision had previously held the record for the highest watched streaming trailer. And that was 53 million people checking out the trailer. And that was post the Emmys last year.
Marvel is not going away anytime soon, that is for sure.
God, no.
Happy Valentine's Day, Dan. We celebrate Valentine's Day this weekend. Happy Valentine's, mate. Will you be my Valentine?
I mean, sure. Like, as long as you're willing to come to the table with one of those sort of giant heart-shaped boxes of chocolates.
Yeah, the whole deal's off. We thought we'd have a look at the real-life couples who've decided to make films or TV shows together. Now, this is not usually a good idea. There's been some good ones along the way, which we'll probably get into during the course of this discussion. But more often than not, there's been some truly awful ones. By my estimation, I would say arguably the most awful recent movie starring a real-life couple is Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie in a movie, By the Sea. I don't know why it has to be so bad. These are pure vanity projects, and that's probably a big reason why, but I don't know if you saw By the Sea, but it is a cumbersome, soporific, totally indulgent drama, and both of them are awful in it.
Here's my question. What even is that film? Like, I don't know that movie. I know their other partnership, which was Mr. and Mrs. Smith, but I don't think I know By the Sea at all.
There was a lot of buzz about it when people started to see it. It just was sent straight to all the home video markets around the world. It is a kind of a Ernest Hemingway and his muse sort of lounging around by the ocean, struggling with booze and inspiration. It is the sort of navel-gazing, indulgent piece of filmmaking that stars think are really important and get made because they're stars, but in every other respect just doesn't need to exist. Just like Madonna in her then husband Guy Ritchie's film Swept Away, another seaside set drama, another pure indulgence for both these people. They get to spend 6 weeks together on a tropical island and make a movie at the same time, and in the end nobody wanted to see it, and quite frankly nobody should have seen it. It's awful.
I've never really found Madonna to be a compelling reason to see a movie.
Yes, that's very true. I would probably say Dick Tracy with her then partner Warren Beatty is the pinnacle of Madonna movies, and certainly Evita. She was quite good in that, and in smaller parts in League of Their Own, stuff like that. But look, Swept Away is just one of the prettiest looking films you'll ever see, but just one of the most insufferable movies you'll ever make. Why do married couples want to make movies together? Didn't work for Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton in Cleopatra. Did work for Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton in Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. But Cleopatra was at the whim of their egos and blew out into this massive production that almost ruined 20th Century Fox. Also at the whim of their egos was The Marrying Man, which starred Alec Baldwin and Kim Basinger, the movie that they got together on, and they just rode roughshod over the studio and the production, and the movie came out to some of the most scathing reviews of either of their stars' career. So happy Valentine's Day, but don't make a movie together.
Yeah, there are a couple of good ones, though. So one that you had on your list that you sent through to me during the week was the one that I thought of immediately when you suggested this topic. So John Krasinski and Emily Blunt starring in A Quiet Place, and he directed the film and has directed her in the sequel, which is yet to see a release.
Yeah, they were terrific on screen together. And, you know, when we're talking about these sort of star couplings on screen, Paul Newman and Joanne Woodward made a career out of it. Regardless of what you think of either of their antics off screen, Tom Cruise and Nicole Kidman did work with Stanley Kubrick on Eyes Wide Shut, which was a pretty terrific film. So yeah, there's been some good ones along the way. In the world of television, I'm trying to think, might there be one?
Look, there's a couple. So just as a brief thought, just because we're talking about Marvel in the last break, John Krasinski and Emily Blunt are often quite heavily rumoured to be hired for the new Marvel Fantastic Four film or series, whatever that turns out to be. So that's a persistent rumour that just hasn't quite gone away. So it'd be fun to see that happen because I think both of them have great chemistry. A couple of films and TV shows that came to mind for me. So I didn't just stick to TV. I thought of about a few film ones as well. But I went a little bit off the beaten track. So there were a few people who'd appeared together on screen. So Paul Dano and Zoe Kazan from Ruby Sparks. That came to mind. Goldie Hawn and Kurt Russell in Overboard.
Sure.
Yeah. TV-wise, there was a couple of names that came to mind, but it wasn't people necessarily appearing regularly and stuff. But I've been rewatching The Office recently, and Steve Carell is obviously the star of The Office as Michael Scott, but he had his real-life wife, Nancy, who's a long-time improv performer from before Steve Carell made it big. So when he made it big, I think Nancy sort of just sort of fell into, you know, doing occasional things with Steve and, you know, living off the money. But the two of them appeared for about three or four episodes in The Office as Steve Carell chasing after this real estate agent and then kind of just being awful in her life. But that's his real life wife. And they had like great sort of oddball chemistry together. And on a similar note, not quite the same because it's not quite acting, but regularly if you watch The Late Show with Stephen Colbert, because he's doing this quarantine show where it's like a really confined studio with just him sitting by himself, no audience other than the crew, he'll occasionally have his wife sitting off camera to the couch next to him. Anytime that Evelyn is sitting on the couch near him, you occasionally hear her laughing along in the background, and that gives him so much energy. Like, it's kind of like he feeds completely off enthusing and exciting his wife every time he's on screen. It's so much of a joy to watch that.
Sometimes true love can inspire your creativity, and clearly it does in those examples.
There's a writer team, Robert and Michelle King, who made The Good Wife and The Good Fight and Evil, whole bunch of shows, really great creative partnership. David and Janet Peoples, who wrote 12 Monkeys. David Peoples has written a whole bunch of things. None of them ever as good as 12 Monkeys with his wife, Janet. And then the other one that came to mind for me, and this is going back to movies, David Mamet and Rebecca Pidgeon. Absolute gold, got a great performance out of her in State and Maine.
State and Maine, one of the great films.
Oh, fantastic film. It's definitely one of my favorites. But on the flip side, Dave Mamet and Rebecca Pidgeon in pretty much every other Rebecca Pidgeon thing. So The Spanish Prisoner and Heist are probably the two most egregious. I kind of like her in The Spanish Prisoner, but it's not a good performance. But a really good performance, Joel Coen and Frances McDormand in pretty much every Coen Brothers Frances McDormand film.
Of course, yeah, that is a great pairing, and their creativity and their way of thinking is spot on. So that's a terrific partnership. Sometimes it works. Even people like Bruce Willis and Demi Moore, they made a pretty good little thriller called Mortal Thoughts. They didn't go the big Hollywood blockbuster paycheck kind of movie. They made this little thriller with Glenn Headley, and they were terrific in Mortal Thoughts together. And, you know, I bagged Alec Baldwin and Kim Basinger, but they did a pretty okay remake of The Getaway, which has disappeared a bit. It's not available on any of the streaming platforms or physical media. So if you can get hold of The Getaway, have a look at that.
Indeed. Simon, there was some South by Southwest business going on. What have we got here?
There certainly was. Just as we record this, there is a breaking news about the South by Southwest Aussies. We've got a whole bunch of Aussies who've managed to get into the film section of the famous festival in Texas. Congratulations to Leah Purcell. She's taking her feature film, The Drover's Wife, The Legend of Molly Johnson there. That's an adaptation of her play. Lauren Moffat, who's a virtual reality director. She's got Of Hybrids and Strings going to South by Southwest. Gracie Otto has a documentary, a music doco called Under the Volcano. Jesse Hill has his music video for Julia Stone called Break in competition. And John Bell, the Moo guy, played at Flickerfest here in Sydney and is traveling around the country as we speak. So that's a short film that's going to premiere in the midnight short sections of South by Southwest. A lot of great Aussie talent headed for the online festival this year. South by Southwest is a virtual festival, so a lot of great coverage for some down under filmmakers over in Texas.
Yeah, just confirming, you said Lauren Moffat's a VR filmmaker. Is her film Of Hybrids and Strings a VR feature?
Yes, that's right. Yeah, virtual reality feature. I'm not quite sure how they're going to work that as an online presentation. But yeah, she's certainly made it in there. Lauren Moffat's made some terrific virtual reality films over the years, mostly shorts, but this is a feature-length movie that will have a lot of people talking. She's quite a visionary, Lauren Moffat, so a good bunch of Aussie filmmakers.
Now, Simon, it is the 2021 Lunar New Year, Year of the Ox, I believe.
It is the Year of the Ox. Happy New Year, everyone. This is the biggest movie-going day on the Chinese calendar. We've got in Australian cinemas to coincide with their Chinese release, Detective Chinatown 3, A Writer's Odyssey, China Line's own Boonie Bears, The Wildlife, advanced screenings of this animated epic called Ne Zha Reborn, and we're very fortunate to be talking to Mick Robbins from China Line about the Chinese New Year blockbusters.
Now, before we throw to Mick, just letting people know, Boonie Bears is a really interesting title in that in the early 2010s, it was a very successful animated show in China. But much like everything in the Western world, like, you know, it was successful. So let's spend it off to a whole bunch of feature films. But yeah, this is the second Boonie Bears film of the series.
I think it's checking out my letterbox listings. I saw this Boonie Bears yesterday and went to post it. And there's been quite a few Boonie Bears films. This is the first one we've seen here in Australia. It's a very big, very spectacular animated movie that sort of starts off a bit like the Trolls films, all color and cartoony fun. Then gets a bit dark and sort of plays out more like the end of Jurassic World. So it's quite a spectacular. The Chinese animation scene is as good as anything that's coming out of Hollywood. It looks beautiful and is part of the movie-going Chinese New Year celebrations that'll sweep the international box office over the next few days.
Yeah, look, I want to know more. Let's have a chat with Mick.
Chinese New Year weekend represents three of the biggest movie-going days of the international movie-going year. In 2020, the global box office took a $1 billion hit when COVID-19 shut down Chinese cinemas. How are things looking for the first days of the Year of the Ox, 2021? If anyone should know, and you ought to know, Mick Robbins is the COO of China Line Film Entertainment. China Line Film Entertainment was founded back in 2010 and is responsible for the biggest roster of Chinese films outside China. They ship into New Zealand, Australia, North America. Mick Robbins is here to answer some questions. How are you, mate?
Good, Simon. How are you? Thanks for having me.
Absolute my pleasure. Put it in perspective, just how big is New Year cinema going to the mainland Chinese population? What place does cinema hold as a traditional social activity?
Well, I'll answer it in two parts. Typically, the Chinese New Year period represents 10 to 15% of China's annual box office. So that gives you an indication of the surge of ticket sales just through that 10-day holiday period, which is Chinese New Year, usually between January and February, depending on the calendar, the horoscope.
And has that always been the case?
It's always been the case, Simon, certainly for the last 5 or 6 years. As you probably know, I mean, the mainland Chinese cinema business has really grown exponentially over the last 5 or 6 years. You know, prior to that, let's go 10 years ago, mainland cinema really didn't exist. You know, all our Chinese films that we saw in the Western world were mainly out of Hong Kong. You know, the Cantonese films, the Bruce Lee's Jets, you know that martial arts stuff. But now we're seeing a lot more. And as you know, Chinese cinemas is, it's the biggest generator of box office receipts in the world now.
What does an overseas market like Australia or New Zealand or the US represent to the Chinese sector? The madness of last year aside, what has the growth been like for Chinese films since China Line came into the market?
Look, to be honest, the box office here is just a speck in terms of what the Chinese box office is. We rarely register on the radar. However, if I look at how Australia and New Zealand compares to, say, North America, the next largest English-speaking territory, we hold our own. I mean, in fact, I think in a lot of cases, our films here probably do as much, if not more, than what they do in North America. That's USA and Canada.
Hey, you were talking about the 15% of the box office is made up by, the Chinese New Year period. Do you see the same reflected in the Australian box office? So is this generally a busier time for the community to actually get out and see cinema?
Look, they will. I mean, the Chinese box office here, The box office for Chinese language films here in Australia has grown incredibly over the years. To give you an example, I think in 2018, we had around about 40 titles all up, generating around about 6.5 mil. 2019, same amount of titles, and a little less, 34, and nearly 12 million in box office receipts. Last year, unfortunately, 2020, down to 2.3, but that, you know, obviously is impacted by COVID. But yeah, you know, it's a strong growth area and has been for a number of years for our cinema circuits here in Australia and New Zealand.
Mate, the Chinese industry is seeing really big dollars and big stars, I guess, flow in and out of the region. Is there a threat to the national cinema of China and all that it represents by that sort of Hollywood influence? Or alternatively, might the opposite be true? There are some big bucks going out of China to fund overseas production.
Good question, Simon. Look, in my opinion, this is just my opinion, I think they'll work well with each other. You know, it's a bit of hand in glove. I mean, the Chinese, the American studios, the Hollywood studios, these days, you know, they have to get their films into China. You know, China is delivering more box office now and more receipts than America is. Back in years gone by, you know, a Hollywood film would hope to retrieve all of their expenditure back from the North American release, and then everything else around the world would be just cream on top. But these days, you know, they've got a lot more cream just out of China. In fact, it's mountains of gold. So, you know, there's, you know, the Chinese stars that you see, you know, appear now in Hollywood films. And then the Chinese have still got this great infatuation with, you know, Hollywood. So they love watching their Hollywood films as well. So it's, I think they both work well together. I think we can see, and there'll be a competition between the two. You know, who keeps hold of the mantle of the biggest, you know, box office in the world.
Do a bit of spruiking, mate. What have China Line got for the New Year period?
We've got a great little animated film. In fact, it's the first time I've tested it. There's a franchise called Boonie Bears. It's an animated franchise. It's been going for a long time in China. Does exceptionally well. And we've never released a family stroke kids movie in the Chinese language here in Australia. So we're going out with it now. Now, this Chinese New Year, there's six big titles, and they are, you know, they're looking huge in China. Detective Chinatown 3, probably the big one. Well, not probably, it is a big one. It's already taken up around about 75% of the pre-sales in China. You know, Chinese New Year last year had zero box office, obviously because of the shutdown. The year before, it was around about $6 billion. You know, there's a lot of forecasts out there now for it to be very close to that this year, even though the cinemas over there are running at like 75% capacity. Beijing probably down to 50%, which was announced last week. You know, in terms of our film, Boonie Bears, I'm really crossing fingers, because Chinese New Year is a real family time, that we can see this work and then go on and continue to offer, you know, more kids product for the Chinese families here in Australia.
We'll get the trailer for Boonie Bears, the wildlife, up on our Facebook page so people can check it out. Mick Robbins, thank you so much for joining us. All the very best. Happy New Year to you. Good luck with Boonie Bears and with China Line in the months ahead.
Thanks, Simon. Thanks, Dan. Really appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
Huge thanks to Mick Robin for having a chat to us about Chinese distribution. I didn't really know much about the distribution of Chinese fare into Australia, and it's something that keeps on catching my attention, because I look at the event cinemas particularly, huge chain, and you wouldn't expect to see a lot of anything other than Hollywood fare and the occasional Australian thing slipped in there, and there's a lot of Australian films that don't really get a play at events as well. But I have noticed a massive increase in a number of films coming in Mandarin language.
Yeah, look, over the last couple of years, international cinema, not just from China, but certainly Indian films, Indonesian films, films from Thailand are getting a huge play. Event and Hoyts and Reading cinemas are, you know, really getting clever about the way they program, certainly to their suburban multiplexes as well. You'll see a whole lot of films that don't get play anywhere else turn up in places like Bankstown or Blacktown or those sort of things where there's strong communities, international communities, and that's working particularly well. You'll often see international films break into the Australian box office in their first couple of weeks because there's a lot of the Australian community are following the international release of films down under, and hopefully more Caucasian, more white audiences will get along and see these films, because certainly over the last 12 months, 2020 being what it is, there hasn't been a lot of Hollywood blockbusters turn up, so maybe some of these films, much in the same way that Australian films have found an audience in the wake of, you know, empty screens everywhere, people are heading out to see Aussie films, and maybe we'll check out some more international cinema.
Yeah, just on the flip side to that, I was reading an article from the LA Times during the week, and they were talking about how you've got Hollywood films that have been trying to push into China quite substantially over the last decade or so. Mm-hmm. And the big problem that you've got with Hollywood films, and we feel the impacts of that here, is that you'll watch it and things will be very sort of politically favorable to the Chinese government. But then on top of that as well, there'll be sort of themes and storylines which are very much geared towards being safe to play there. Or there might be an actor from China who gets inserted into scenes to try to create a local presence and create an opportunity for that film to play in China. Sure. Reason for that, the Chinese box office, huge market, and obviously they want to try to capitalize on that at a time where film budgets have skyrocketed out of control and they need to be able to monetize this on a global scale. China's an important part of that. But there's an interesting thing that's happened over this last year, and this is kind of, this year it's obvious, whereas in the last couple of years it's been building towards this. Very little Hollywood product is actually playing in China because there's very little Hollywood product really playing anywhere. Yeah. The thing is that in the last couple of years, China have actually invested a huge amount of money in really upping the scale and scope of a lot of their films playing. So there's films coming out of China which are very much playing at like a Hollywood level.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
Of film coming out. And with that sort of stuff happening locally, the Chinese market, they're looking at these Hollywood films saying, well, we don't really need them. And when they do launch in China, like, they're not really as appealing as the stuff that's local and homegrown that actually speaks to the thoughts and concerns that people there actually have. So it's kind of this thing where Hollywood in this year without Hollywood, it's kind of just proved that it's a little bit irrelevant in this market.
It's a two-tiered campaign on behalf of the Chinese industry. All of that is true. They're making these big action adventure blockbuster films, the likes of which we're used to seeing out of Hollywood, just as you say. On the other side of that, they are doing a lot of investing into American filmmaking and international filmmaking, and good on them for demanding that Chinese actors, mainland actors, are being cast in those films in roles that they may not have otherwise been cast in, ensuring that these movies will play on Chinese cinemas. So I think that's a great thing, expanding the diverse casting base around the world of blockbusters. In the past, where Hollywood has dominated the international movie-going scene and Chinese language films are sort of pushed to the art house, and there is some great art house Chinese cinema still coming out, of course, the Chinese blockbusters are really taking hold and holding their own in cinemas all over the world.
Now, speaking of movies, and let's talk about some TV as well, we do reviews here on this show. Simon, do you want to kick us off? I think you've got a brand new Australian film.
Lovely.
Is it Australian?
It is Australian. Long Story Short is a new Aussie film from director Josh Lawson.
Congratulations on your upcoming wedding.
I don't know how upcoming it is. He wants at a date.
We'll talk about it later.
Later.
Teddy, what is it with you and later?
It is a sort of a fantasy rom-com. A young man named Teddy, played very well by Rafe Spall. He wakes up every morning, or wakes up after a few minutes, and finds his whole life has progressed a year. So he gets to see the results of his living exactly 1 year down the track and reassess exactly where his life's going. He realizes he's losing control of his life. Marriage is falling apart. His kids are growing up without having any connection to him. and he has to try and figure out exactly how to make the most out of the year that he's away from himself. Very sweet story. Rafe is very good in the part. Zara Newman is terrific as his long-suffering wife. There are certainly elements of Groundhog Day in this story. In fact, the film references Groundhog Day, incorrectly it should be said, but it references it in a couple of scenes. It doesn't quite nail the premise like Groundhog Day did. There were a few holes in this conceit that I found a little bit frustrating, like where does this other person go all year? What happens to the person who turns up for those few minutes when he wakes between years? So the premise isn't fully thought out, which doesn't really affect you watching it. There are some very sweet moments and some very funny moments in Long Story Short. Not the sort of contemporary rom-com stuff that the Aussie industry does a whole lot, so it's good to see. And Josh Lawson's a talent. He wrote and directed this film, and hopefully we'll get to see a whole lot more of what Josh does. He spent a lot of time in Hollywood lately, but has come home to make this sweet little film.
Yeah, Rafe's full British actor. Is he doing an Aussie accent or is he playing it as a Brit?
No, going full Brit. Joins the long list of Brit actors who are coming out here to play leading man parts. We saw it in Top End Wedding, we saw it in The Sapphires, we've seen it in a couple of other films as well. So the exchange program between our industry and the UK one is alive and well.
Yeah, Rafe Spall, I can think of two movies of his I've generally liked. Mm. Outside of that, I find it a pretty dire affair.
What was that Netflix thing he did about the four friends that go off into the jungle or go off into the forest and find themselves up against some spirit? The ritual or the sacrifice or something like that. He was quite good in that, and certainly comes from good genes. I mean, Tim Spall is his father, the great British actor. So, and he's very much playing the young contemporary man in this one. It's just all personality and not quite sure of his life, the way it's unfurling. So, good film. Nice film.
Something else which we probably need to talk about is the new Silence of the Lambs spin-off of sorts, Clarice.
You are a woman with a very public reputation for hunting monsters.
I can't have a reputation. I've only done it once.
It's time you own that reputation. It's time to come out of hiding, starling.
Silence of the Lambs, it came out when I was 11 years old, so it's definitely a film I came to later in life. And the interesting thing with Silence of the Lambs is that the thing that I know Silence of the Lambs more for is all the iconography and elements of the film that were pretty much, I'm going to say, stolen by The X-Files. So The X-Files opens up with similar like title card sequences. So when you see like the establishing shots and explains where you are in Silence of the Lambs, they've got exactly the same visual motif happening in The X-Files as well, where the fonts are very similar as well. You've got the Dana Scully character from The X-Files, who's basically just Clarice Starling, but just, you know, doing supernatural stuff with Fox Mulder. A lot of The X-Files DNA comes from Silence of the Lambs. So when I saw Silence of the Lambs a few years later, it felt very much like an extended X-Files episode, just one of those episodes where they didn't really do much supernatural stuff, but really it was like just a serial killer of the week sort of an episode. So I feel that a lot of the resonance that a lot of viewers had watching Silence of the Lambs was lost on me a little bit, because I'd kind of seen this on a weekly basis on this TV show that I was very much obsessed with as a teenager. As such, I've never really gone back to Silence of the Lambs, but I have really kept up with the Harris universe, I guess, of shows and movies that have come since. So there was the very well-regarded Hannibal show, there was the less well-regarded Hannibal movie, there was the Red Dragon remake with Ed Norton in it, and like all those I thought were fine to very good in the instance of the Hannibal TV show. So you've got Clarice as the most recent attempt to try to tap into this universe, and it's got a lot of big FBI boots to fill. Doesn't necessarily live up to the expectation, and I think the answer quite resoundingly from myself, I believe you've got the same viewpoint, and critics broadly, is no, it does not. This is a show that's very much a CBS procedural, but the way that I've approached it, because as I said, like I came to Silence of the Lambs through this X-Files framework, I kept on looking at Clarice, which is very much a episode of the... It's not quite an X-Files episode, but post the X-Files, do you remember there's a whole bunch of TV shows that tried more or less aping the style of the X-Files, which in turn was a reflection of Silence of the Lambs? So you had shows like the X-Files quasi spin-off Millennium. Mm-hmm. There was another show called Profiler. And Clarice just kind of feels like one of them. And I've been thinking about both of those shows, Profiler and Millennium, and they're far better at doing what they're doing than Clarice is, because Clarice comes to the genre with some very high production values. It's got a very good cast to it, But broadly, it just feels like a generic drama series and also-ran series, because after watching three episodes of this now, other than Clarice, whose name's in the title, I don't think I know the names of any of the characters. Nobody seems to have any sort of personality. There is not a single scene that goes by without a character who needs to provide a large amount of exposition to explain who they are, what their relationship is with the other characters, what they feel about what's going on in every specific situation. Yep. And regardless of how inappropriate it might be for a relationship that's just starting with another coworker or a friend, it just feels like they're going out there just expressing every element, every emotion on their sleeve, there for the screen to really soak in.
You're absolutely right. It's interesting you make the comparison to The X-Files, because after three episodes, that's what I took home from it. You and I come to the original film, to Silence of the Lambs, from a very different perspective. It was right in the middle of my mid-20s, soaking up everything to do with movies, so it's a seminal film in my movie going experience. This doesn't get anywhere near the gravitas or the importance of Silence of the Lambs. I agree that it is really just a week by week procedural story. There is an underlying bridging sort of narrative, which is what also reminds me of the X-Files, of the episode.
Of the three episodes we've seen, it's actually, like, I'm curious to know what the structure of this is as a series unravels, because episode one is chasing down a specific serial killer, or maybe they're not a serial killer, yeah, as the story progresses. But then episode two is actually a radically different thing, where it's kind of the story of the week, and it's a Waco-type hostage situation.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
But then episode three just dives straight back into being a continuation from episode one.
And I think the best of the episodes we saw was episode three. It found a bit of its footing by that stage, which gives me a little bit of hope for the future. But from what we've seen, it's middling to fair to middling.
I agree. I think episode three is by far the best of the three episodes, and I hope that the show improves. Like, if the show is heading in that direction, like, it's definitely a show on the up. But I'm a little bit nervous, because even episode three, while much better, it's still not really an engaging watch.
No.
But the only thing that episode three does that the other two don't is it cuts back on that exposition. First of all, you know where all the characters have come from, because boy, have they told you repeatedly through that first episode.
That first episode is very talky. By the time it gets to, and as we say, it's been an X-Files riff up until that point. Episode three is more a Mindhunter type of storytelling. It's the questioning in the police station, and the tension is there in a very familiar setting, but the tension is still there.
Now, you used the word Mindhunter, really harkening back to the original Hannibal Lecter film. Mm-hmm. But when I was watching episode three of this, I was thinking of the David Fincher TV series Mindhunter,
yeah,
which approaches this from a much better, much more sophisticated, much more analytically adult sort of a viewpoint on it all. Where I think that the Mindhunter show does exceptionally well mining very similar territory to this is that it's actually got some, like, very deliberate pace to it. And unlike Clarice, which is very much heavily edited with jump shots regularly going back and forth, I don't think a single shot ever lasts more than about 2.5 seconds. Mm. And when you're trying to build tension, like, that's the last thing you want. Like, tension really comes from sticking with a moment for longer than you expect it to. Clarice never does that at all. And so it becomes less a artistic expression of really getting into the minds and hearts of serial killers and the FBI agents who are chasing them down, and instead just becomes a very generic CBS procedural. Now, Simon, another film that I'm very keen to see is Another Round.
Jeg har lyst til at starte aftenen med lidt champagne.
Det lyder dejligt.
Jeg er i bil. Jeg skal bare have en dansk mand uden citrus.
Uden citrus, ja tak.
Ja.
Kæft, det er godt, det her.
Ja, det er sgu synd, du er så fornuftig.
Men spørgsmålet er, hvad der i virkeligheden er fornuftigt. Der findes en norsk filosof. Han mener, at mennesket er født med en halv promille for lidt.
Altså, jeg må sige, jeg kunne da godt sådan bruge en halv promille sådan på daglig basis for at få lidt mere selvtillid.
Det har vi da alle sammen brug for. Det har du da også brug for.
Yes, also in cinemas this week is the new film from my man, Mads Mikkelsen, the great Mads Mikkelsen. He's getting some of the best reviews and some of the most sort of immediate awards attention for his latest. It's the Thomas Vinterberg film, Another Round. In this movie, four friends, four high school teachers, test a theory that there is a theory that our body does not have the right amount of alcohol in it to sort of keep us balanced. And so what these four high school teachers decide to do is to rev up their lives by going to work every day with 0.05% alcohol in their blood. What unfolds is at times a very funny, but also a kind of message movie which hides its message underneath that funny. And that's what's clever about Another Round. As someone who celebrated their seventh year without a drop of alcohol this week, watching Another Round was was an interesting experience, one that made me realize both the pleasures and the evils of alcohol in equal measure. And I think Mickelson, with his final sequence in this film, and I won't give too much away because it's an absolute joy to watch, he's headed towards some serious award season recognition and not a moment too soon. Another round has already cleaned up at the European Film Awards late last year, and I think Mickelson is on his way to a whole bunch more. So check out another round as soon as possible.
Yeah, look, I'm very keen on this. I saw the trailer. I hadn't really had any awareness of it previously, but saw the trailer before something else the other week at the cinema, and it very much caught my interest. Looks very funny, yeah, very charming.
It is indeed. And we've also got one more film to have a look at, a very sort of creepy sci-fi thriller called Synchronic. Now, you've had a look at this. What are the thoughts?
Yeah, so this is the latest film from Justin Benson and Aaron Moorhead, two directors that I really quite like a fair bit. Two of their previous films, so Resolution and The Endless, two films that I absolutely adored. So I was very high anticipation coming into this one. Basically, the premise of it is that you've got two paramedics played by Anthony Mackie and Jamie Dornan. Jamie Dornan's almost adult teenage daughter has disappeared. There's some sort of synthetic drug that's out on the streets that they keep on encountering through their work as paramedics. And very quickly, the Anthony Mackie character realizes that that drug is actually related to the disappearance of the daughter. And I don't think it's a massive spoiler because I think it's in all the trailers and all the other material surrounding it. But basically, the synthetic drug gives people the ability to time travel. And so the daughter has more or less phased out of the current time stream and is somewhere else. So Anthony Mackie's character is trying to figure out where she is and how he can get to her. It's a very dark sci-fi. It's a very grounded sci-fi film. Like, there isn't particularly special effects heavy by any means. You and I, we had different experiences. I actually saw it at the cinema with you. Yes. What did you think of it?
Unlike you, I'm a little bit down on these two directors. I quite enjoyed their film Spring, which I think was one of theirs.
But, yeah, I think it was their first.
I didn't connect with The Endless. I didn't connect with Synchronic. I thought it was understated and a little bit mysterious to the point of being a little bit boring. I don't think they played out, and this may be a budget issue because they didn't have a lot of money to work with on this film, but it didn't really explore the concept of the time travel. There was one really interesting scene where Anthony Mackie suddenly finds himself in the land of the dinosaurs, and I thought, gee, I'd love to see the film go deep into this sort of realities and then this sort of shifting time frames. I don't think it does that. Visually, these guys are great. They know how to make a film look good. For me, they just haven't really connected with how to tell a story yet. But Mackie is very good. Jamie Dornan is very good, who I've only seen in a handful of films, most of them the 50 Shades of Grey movies. So to see him actually put in a fairly nuanced performance here is a big plus. So I'll keep watching these guys because I know they've got a good film in them, but I just don't think it's come along yet.
Yeah, see, I actually really like their understated approach to most of their films. Like, that's, to me, one of the big selling points for these guys. I'm pretty much there for anything they do going forward. The thing with this film, and the reason why I found it slightly disappointing, is purely I think that the third act doesn't really quite live up to the really interesting ideas that they'd come up with throughout the film. They've come up with this sort of idea of this interesting, like, synthetic drug on the streets. Like, maybe just do more with where that's actually come from, rather than just sort of accept that, oh, there's a drug on the street, and that's really used as a mechanism to get to the time travel, as opposed to maybe exploring who created this? Like, what sort of lab has this come out of? Like, there's just interesting aspects to the drug manufacturing that I kind of wish that they'd focus on a bit more than just the very sort of perfunctory, you know, Anthony Mackie's worked out where the daughter is, he goes and gets her. And there's a little bit more to it than that, but it was really just like a, hey, we've had our cool idea, let's just wrap this up and get out, as opposed to really thinking what was cool about the idea to begin with and mining that just that little bit further. And that's all I found lacking from it. Beyond that, visually, there's a number of shots in this film, and the overall mood and sensation of the film has stuck with me really heavily since I saw it. Like, there's so much that I liked about it, but that third act just kind of really just sunk it.
The movie is Synchronic in cinemas everywhere as we speak. Also in cinemas is, and neither of us have seen this, but doing the rounds is the new Jeremy Irons, Diane Keaton film, Love, Weddings and Other Disasters, which looks like a fairly broad rom-com premise, and a terrific documentary called Wild Things, A Year on the Front Line of Environmental Activism. This is an Aussie doc which looks at the school-age kids who taking on the environmental issues because the politicians won't. under the banner Change is Coming. So Wild Things is definitely one to check out as well.
Yeah, there's a couple of previews this weekend. So The Little Things, which is one of the HBO Max Warner Brothers films that got a streaming release in the US, but here we get it on a big screen. So previews all weekend for that. Minari, which I haven't seen yet, but I'm super stoked to check it out because word is beyond bonkers good.
Yeah, look, I've seen it. We're going to rave about it next week, but Minari's another film that's shaping up as a real big award series contender.
Yeah, there's a couple of retro screenings, so you can watch the three original Star Wars films, so episodes 4, 5, and 6. They were all playing back-to-back at a number of cinemas around Australia, including the Ritz and the Orpheum in Sydney, the Astor in Melbourne, the Backlot Cinema in Perth. I think Hoyts as well might be playing at a number of cinemas around the country.
Yeah, I think they are. The distributor's giving that a big push. Breakfast at Tiffany's, the 60th anniversary screening. This is the big Valentine's Day movie that cinemas all around the country are pushing. It's playing at the Orpheum. It's playing at the Astor in Melbourne, the Capri Theatre in Adelaide. Palace Cinemas nationwide have got it, and at the beautiful Elizabeth Pitcher Theatre up there in Brisbane. Bear in mind, there are some problematic elements in Breakfast at Tiffany's that have been addressed in some controversy, so be wary going in that Mickey Rooney's performance maybe isn't as memorable for all the wrong reasons as it was all those years ago, but it's still a lovely film.
Do you want to give us your favourite Mickey Rooney impersonation? No, let's not do that.
No, I do not.
If you're a fan of the Coen brothers, pretty much every Friday night until the beginning of June, you've got the Classic Cinema in Melbourne and the Randall Kuritz in Sydney. They're playing Coen Brothers films every Friday night. There's a different one. So I believe this week there's 1987's Raising Arizona.
Still arguably my favourite Coen Brothers film. I know they've made better movies, but there's no movie I've seen more than Raising Arizona and still provides some big, big laughs. So yeah, the season ends on Friday, June 4 with a rare big screen showing of The Ballad of Buster Scruggs, which went straight to Netflix, but should be seen on the big screen. I can't wait for that one. Also next week in Melbourne, the Melbourne Women in Film Festival, mwff.org.au for details. It kicks off on this from the 17th to the 24th, leading off with Kathy Drayton's environmental documentary, The Weather Diary. So Melbourne listeners, get along to that. Support women filmmakers.
Indeed. Do we want to talk about Acme as well?
After many months sort of shut down and being refurbished, the new Australian Centre for the Movie Image is opening in Melbourne as we speak. $40 million redevelopment it's undergone. The Museum of Screen Culture is welcoming audiences to the newly transformed setting down there in Fed Square in Melbourne. I can't wait to go down and have a look at this. Australian Centre for the Moving Image is one of my favourite places in Australia, and the work they do to preserve our film culture, our television culture, our screen culture, is second to none. So get along and check out this amazing new facility, and hopefully in the weeks ahead we'll be able to have a chat with someone from down there to get an insight into exactly what they're doing.
Yeah, look, and it's not all gone to the movies and seeing stuff on a big screen. There's a bit of small screen stuff to get through as well. New and returning TV this week, and actually it's only new TV I want to focus on here. Behind Horizons is a new series on Netflix. The one to watch is a youth-orientated comedy on ABC, former ABC 2, I think it's called ABC TV Plus now. But the way most people are watching it is all the episodes will be on the streaming service ABC iView, and it's a show called Why You Like This. And I believe that we're talking to some of the talent involved in that for next week's podcast. I've got a couple of big screen movies which are going straight to streaming here, including the Tom Hanks film News of the World. Now, News of the World, I can't believe we haven't reviewed it on this week's show. We might just talk about it next week. I honestly think this has definitely been one of my films of the year. Hadn't expected to love it anywhere near as much as I did, but boy, I think that's just like an incredible piece of cinema.
Hanks continues to deliver. I finally caught up with Greyhound through the week, the Apple Plus movie, World War II Navy set movie. He's fantastic in that, which is a fantastic film. And yes, I'm looking forward to seeing News of the World, which we'll chat about next week.
You know what? I didn't really like Greyhound very much for the reason that I was actually a bit apprehensive about News of the World, in that Tom Hanks likes to play around with movies where he has some sort of historical bent to it. And it feels very much like Tom Hanks playing role play stuff more than actually embodying a role. Like, it's like he's just intellectually interested in reading history books about something and wants to make a movie about it. I never really quite buy it. And so Greyhound very much felt like, hey, I'd like to do a World War II thing. And News I think the world he's very earnest.
I think he's sort of very committed to telling the sort of true World War story, World War II stories, and the soldiers' experience, the theatre of war experience. I think Greyhound suffered a little bit in many people's eyes because it almost relied entirely on special effects and CGI to convey the battle scenes. And in that regard, it does lose a little bit of its authenticity. But no, I thought Hanks was great in that, and by all accounts, great in News of the World. Is he in that Meryl Streep zone now where some of his performances really should be nominated for Oscars, but they're just not? I think that happened last year, and I may be corrected if I'm wrong, but that happened last year for A Beautiful Day in Your Neighborhood. I don't think he was nominated for that, but
It got nominations. I don't know if he specifically got the nominations, though.
Yeah, I think everyone just thinks, great, Tom Hanks, another great performance, like they're doing that with Meryl lately. So we'll certainly check out News of the World and chat more next week. To All the Boys, Always and Forever is the third.
Speaking of great cinema.
This one isn't exactly aimed at us, per se.
No.
But To All the Boys series, starring the lovely Lana Condor as Lara Jean, has been a huge hit for the Netflix people. They're churning out these movies, you know, dime a dozen. They're not great cinema, but they're playing to an audience sector which is lapping them up. So To All the Boys, Always and Forever hits Netflix this week.
Oh, look, absolutely. And also there's a Swedish film called Red Dot, which looks kind of interesting. That's also on Netflix this weekend.
Yeah, this is one of these sort of wilderness stories where a couple go out into the snow on a ski trip and they're being stalked by remorseless killers. I love these sort of movies. I'm going to watch that.
Yeah. Oh, no, I'll definitely be checking that as well. Each week on the pod, we do like to wrap things up with a bit of a look back at the history that made us, the foundational texts. We've talked a fair bit about Silence of the Lambs this week. We've got an anniversary this weekend for Silence of the Lambs, 30 years since it debuted in cinemas this weekend.
Extraordinary. Can you imagine taking your betrothed, your loved one, for a Valentine's Day present to see Silence of the Lambs? That's some dark relationship.
Actually, that's exactly the sort of thing that I would take my wife to go and see, and she would love it.
Exactly,
she genuinely loves Silence of the Lambs. Like, she is very much into that.
On the 12th of February in 1993, Groundhog Day, a film we've already referenced once today, premiered, went on to become a classic of its kind. The great Bill Murray, of course, in one of his most beloved roles.
And on the 12th of February, Groundhog Day from 1990. That's a bit of a silly joke, because the Groundhog Day. Yeah.
Oh, that's great.
Hey, what about Brain Dead, which also debuted in 1993 on the 12th of February?
Announced to the world that Peter Jackson was a little bit sick, but also a terrific filmmaker. Brain Dead's a great horror film. And back in 1975, the beautiful Catherine Ross in The Stepford Wives premiered on the 12th of February. So, that was a film that came out of the sexual revolution and was one of the early sort of forebearers of a new wave of feminine cinema. So it's once again, I don't know how it's dated. I haven't seen it for a long time, but The Stepford Wives, you know, has taken on a mythology all of its own.
Couple of birthdays, maybe America's greatest actor, Michael Ironside.
Oh, favorite Michael Ironside film, go.
Oh, look, I've only really got favorite TV shows of Michael Ironside. If I have to pick a movie, Starship Troopers, because it's the greatest. TV shows, I liked his role as, I think the character's called Ham, in the V, The Final Battle.
Mm.
But also, very memorable for a recurring role in the first bunch of seasons of ER.
And the great Scanners, of course, David Cronenberg's Scanners. He was fantastic in that. The beautiful Australian actress, born in 1959, Sigrid Thornton, has a birthday today. Happy birthday, Ziggy.
Yeah, and Christina Ricci, who I can't believe hasn't been in a Peter Jackson movie. She was born in 1980, so this will be her 40th birthday.
Famous for Wednesday Addams, the great Wednesday Addams. Happy birthday, Christina Ricci. That was a full show. I'm exhausted.
Yeah, bit of a lie down. Have a Bex, have a lie down. It'll all be fine. This has been Screen Watching. My name, it's been Dan Barrett, and will continue to be Dan Barrett, I think. Simon Foster, that's still the case?
It is still the case. See my writings at screen-space.net. Buy tickets to my German sci-fi showcase for Sydney listeners. That's happening February 27. Tickets available through Eventbrite. Come and say hi there.
Indeed. People should subscribe to my daily newsletter. It's called Always Be Watching. You can find it at alwaysbewatching.com. Each day, there's about 10-ish stories which relate to the most interesting things happening in screen culture. So primarily TV, but a little bit of film, a little bit of VR, a bit of video games. Depends what's really around on any given day, but that comes free to your inbox Monday through Friday, And on Friday afternoons, there's a weekly wrap of all the TV shows and movies that have debuted during that week to check out.
Happy Valentine's Day, everyone, and happy Chinese New Year as well. Thanks for joining us on Screen Watching.
Love you, Simon.
Bye-bye.